From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. In this hour, we'll focus on race and segregation in America. In September of 2017, we aired a conversation with Professor Richard Rothstein, senior fellow at the Haas Institute at UC Berkeley School of Law. He had just written his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. He talked with reporter Cosmo Garvin about the history of policies that resulted in segregated communities in California and across the United States.
Many federal, state, and local policies that created residential segregation, but I think the two most important were first the civilian public housing program, which was begun in the New Deal to address a housing shortage primarily for white middle-class, lower-middle-class families who had lost their homes in the Depression. And the federal government, beginning with the Public Works Administration, created segregated public housing projects, separate projects for whites and blacks. Most were for whites, fewer for blacks, in cities across the country, frequently creating segregation in cities which had never known segregation before. Langston Hughes, for example, talks in his autobiography about how he grew up in an integrated neighborhood in Cleveland. His best friend was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl. The neighborhood in Cleveland where he lived was integrated, as were many neighborhoods in cities, north and south at that time, because working families didn't have automobiles and they had to be able to walk to work. Well, the neighborhood that Langston Hughes grew up in was demolished by the Public Works Administration in order to build two separate projects, one for African Americans, one for whites. In other cities, neighborhoods were demolished, integrated neighborhoods, and public housing was built for white families only, and African Americans were left to fend for themselves in other tenement districts, which they wound up overcrowding. So in many cities, this happened. In World War II, workers, both white and black, flocked to centers of defense production to work in manufacturing, ships and tanks and airplanes. The federal government had to provide housing for these workers because the cities had exploding populations as workers flocked to work in defense plants. And again, the federal government created segregation with housing for workers' families in places that had never known it before. Richmond, California, for example, which became one of the largest black ghettos in the state of California, was an all-white community before World War II. But the federal government built housing for blacks along the railroad tracks near the industrial area, housing for whites in the residential areas, creating a segregated pattern that remained for decades afterwards. So that was one policy of the federal government. The second policy, which was perhaps even more powerful, was the Federal Housing Administration, an agency of the federal government that was also formed in the New Deal in 1934, provided subsidies to builders of mass production developments, suburbs. And they provided these subsidies by guaranteeing bank loans for builders to build subdivisions on condition, and this was an explicit federal condition, that no homes be sold to African Americans. Perhaps the best known of these is Levittown, just east of New York City, 17,000 homes. The Levitt family could never have assembled the capital to build 17,000 homes for which they had no buyers. The only way they did so was by getting bank guarantees from the federal government on condition that they sell no homes to African Americans, and a further condition that they place language in every deed of every home in Levittown prohibiting resale to African Americans. And this was true everywhere in the country. Daly City, Westlake, south of San Francisco, Lakewood, south of Los Angeles, Panorama City in the Los Angeles area. All of these giant subdivisions were built with Federal Housing Administration requirements that no homes be sold to African Americans. Well, you put these two programs together, African Americans and whites in public housing, and these FHA policies that suburbanized the country. Come the 1950s, when the civilian housing market began to recover, whites began to leave public housing in order to occupy the single-family homes to which they were being subsidized by the federal government in suburbs. Eventually, public housing became all African-American or predominantly African-American because the African-Americans had no option to leave central cities. The whites did. And so you have the situation as a result of these two federal government policies where a white noose was created around central cities with suburbs from which African Americans were excluded and African Americans increasingly given no housing options outside the neighborhoods where public housing and tenement districts were located.
Today, we think of the New Deal as being this liberal set of policies or this progressive set of policies. We don't think of the New Deal as being a tool for segregation. So is that what you mean in the subtitle of your book when you say this is a forgotten history?
Yes, that's exactly what I mean, because this wasn't a hidden history. It was well known at the time. There's nothing hidden about it. The Federal Housing Administration's manual told appraisers that they couldn't appraise a home for a mortgage at the low risk of mortgage guarantee if it was in a neighborhood where African Americans might live. At one point, the Federal Housing Administration, in my book, The Color of Law, I have a picture of this. The Federal Housing Administration required the developer of a white subdivision to build a 6-foot-high cement wall separating the development from a nearby African-American neighborhood, and only then would the FHA insure the mortgages in that development and guarantee the construction loans. So it was well known, public housing that was segregated. It's not that African-Americans happened to apply to some projects and whites happened to apply to others. The projects were specifically designated by race. So it has been a forgotten history. And because it's been forgotten, we're hobbled in our ability to deal with issues of racial segregation, because the conventional myth that this all happened by accident and by private prejudice and personal choices, if that's really how it happened, it's very difficult to think of how you could have a similar number, millions of private choices and prejudicial actions to undo it. If we understand that it was actually created by the federal government with state and local government support, then we can easily begin to talk about ways that the federal government can equally undo segregation that it created. So something that was done by public policy can be reversed by public policy. Something that was just done by accident, it's hard to figure out how to reverse it.
So these explicitly discriminatory practices are 50 years in the past now, and yet these patterns of segregation persist, even in a city like Sacramento, which I understand is comparatively better integrated than many cities. We still see these patterns. So why do they persist?
Well, the policies of residential segregation are much more embedded and difficult to reverse than other segregation policies. When we abolished segregation on buses, for example, the next day an African American could sit anywhere he or she wanted on a bus. When we abolished segregation in restaurants, the next day anybody could go into a restaurant and be served. When we abolished segregation in schools, if a law had been enforced, African Americans could go to their neighborhood school, regardless of what the majority race in that school was. If we were to abolish segregation in housing, which the government equally created, it's hard to figure out what happens next. Can African Americans suddenly pick up and move to all white suburbs from which they've been excluded? No, that's very difficult. In fact, it's virtually impossible. In the mid-20th century, when these massive subdivisions were created, places like Levittown and Panorama City and Lakewood and Daly City, when those subdivisions were created, those homes sold for about $8,000, $10,000 a piece. At today's currency, that's about $100,000. $100,000 then was about, in today's currency, was about twice national median income. Working class families, whether black or white, could have afforded to buy those homes. Working class whites did. Working class African Americans were forced to live in apartments in central cities, not permitted to move to suburbs. Today, those homes that sold for $100,000 to working class families 60 years ago, they sell now for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. That's 7-8 times national median income. They're now unaffordable to working class families, black or white. So although we passed a fair housing law saying that, okay, African Americans, you can now move to these suburbs from which the federal government previously excluded you, it didn't do much to undo the past segregation because those homes are now unaffordable to working class families. Even middle-class families, white and black, can no longer afford to move to single-family homes in the suburbs. Today, nationwide, African-American incomes are about 60% of white incomes. African-American wealth is only about 5% of white wealth on average. And that enormous difference, a 60% income ratio, a 5% wealth ratio, is almost entirely attributable to unconstitutional federal housing policy in the mid-20th century. And we need to be creative in figuring out how to reverse that, because its effects endure today in this enormous wealth gap and in the concentration of African Americans, many African Americans in cities, and the suburbanization of the white population.
A few years back, when I first learned about your research, was when you wrote an article called The Making of Ferguson, and you really explore some of these ideas about how segregation was created, but also really talk about the consequences of that segregation, and these are some of the worst possible consequences. And you even say that when Ferguson happened is when we started to rediscover some of this history. So I was just wondering, can you just talk a little bit more about the effects of this kind of residential racial segregation?
Many of the most serious social problems we face in this country today have their foundations in residential segregation, which has never been addressed. For example, when we have violence between police and young African-American men, as in Ferguson or in Baltimore or in Milwaukee or in Charlotte, that can only happen. That can only take place in segregated neighborhoods where police are an occupying force, not a force that serves and protects, where young men are concentrated in areas where there are no jobs and no access to jobs and are hopeless. If they were living throughout the metropolitan area in integrated communities, police would not be able to have the kind of aggressive policies that they have towards young men. And young men wouldn't be standing around on the streets jobless with no opportunities. So those problems are attributable to residential segregation. The lack of mobility that we bemoan so much in public policy today is attributable to residential segregation in large part. African-American children who are poor, if they grow up in a low-income neighborhood, are much more likely to be poor as adults than equally poor African-American children who grow up in an integrated neighborhood and are more likely to be middle class as adults. So that problem, too, has its roots in residential segregation. So unless we learn this history and confront the need to undo it, to remedy the unconstitutional policies of the federal government, these enormous social problems are going to continue and could possibly get worse.
After a break, we'll hear the second part of Cosmo Garvin's conversation with Richard Rothstein. It's from September of 2017. This is Insight on Capital Public Radio. Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Now to continue the conversation between reporter Cosmo Garvin and Professor Richard Rothstein. Rothstein, in this part of the talk, addresses what happens when a constitutional right is violated.
If a constitutional right is violated, there's an obligation to remedy it. It's not a matter of choice. It's not a matter of popular majority. There's an obligation to remedy a violation of the Constitution if we're going to preserve our standing as a constitutional democracy. Realistically, we don't remedy constitutional violations unless there's, if not a majority, at least a substantial body of public support in favor of that remedy. And that's why learning this history is so critically important, because we're not about to begin remedying these violations as we are obligated to do unless there's popular support for remedies, and that will only come from learning this history.
You write in your book briefly about a policy under the Obama administration called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule. And then the history of this policy to me is really interesting because it goes all the way back to the 60s and something called the Open Communities Policy. Can you talk a little bit about the history of that rule and what Obama tried to do to revive that policy?
In 1968, Richard Nixon was elected president, and it's illustrative of how well known these constitutional violations were at the time. He was a Republican, and yet his Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, a fellow by the name of George Romney, the father of the recent presidential candidate, was determined to remedy these constitutional violations. And in the Nixon cabinet, as Secretary of Housing, he developed a program called Open Communities, in which he required suburbs to take steps to reverse the segregation that had been imposed by government. And he threatened to withhold federal funds for the things that suburbs get money for sidewalks, for sewers, for open space, threatened to withhold federal funds from suburbs that did not repeal zoning ordinances that prohibited the construction of modest townhouses or homes on smaller lots, apartments, all zoning rules that were designed to keep African Americans out of suburbs. If suburbs didn't repeal those rules, if they didn't permit the construction of moderate income housing, he was going to withhold federal funds. And in fact, he did withhold funds from three suburbs. Baltimore County was one, a suburb of Michigan, Warren, that he was familiar with because he had been governor of Michigan, was a second, and another was an area in Ohio. He withheld federal funds from those three areas. President Nixon reined him in, canceled the Open Communities Program, and George Romney was forced out as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development as a result. Well, nothing serious was done to reverse residential segregation after that for many years. As you mentioned, the Obama administration, in its last years, developed a rule called the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing Rule, which returned to this policy that had been attempted by George Romney, requiring suburbs to develop plans to desegregate. Ultimately, the threat was that if suburbs didn't develop plans to desegregate, federal funds could be withheld from them. But that was not to be because the Obama administration is no longer in office. And I think there's not political support for doing it because, again, people have forgotten the history. So even if Hillary Clinton had been elected and if she pursued the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing program, I don't think she would have been any more successful in doing so than George Romney had been 65 years earlier, because there's no political support for doing it, again, because we're so ignorant of this history.
The current HUD secretary, Ben Carson, I think, did you mention that he has been skeptical of this kind of rule?
His remarks are a good illustration of how we've forgotten this history. He characterized this rule as a form of social engineering, which he says he opposes because social engineering can have unintended consequences, which are problems. And he's absolutely right. What he fails to recognize is that the rule is not a form of social engineering. It's a form of undoing social engineering that was committed by the government in the mid-20th century. It's true there may be problems in enforcing it. There may be some unintended consequences. But that's a price we have to pay for remedying a constitutional violation.
Carson's response is really sort of the same objection you hear against any kind of policy for more inclusion. And that objection is, don't tell us what kind of neighborhoods we can live in. Don't tell us what kind of neighborhoods we can build. In a way, I guess you're saying, you know, it's too late.
What I'm saying is the federal government did tell us what kinds of neighborhoods we should live in and who should be our neighbors and what kinds of homes we can build. And it did so in an unconstitutional fashion. It's not as though people live in all white suburbs because they chose to live away from each other. It's because the federal government established these suburbs on an all-white basis. So these programs of reform are not an attempt to restrict people's choices. They're an attempt to undo a restriction that was created by government in the mid-20th century.
What are some of the remedies that you suggest?
Well, there are many remedies. The federal government today operates two programs, primarily directed at helping the housing needs of low-income families. One is called the Section 8 voucher program, the Housing Choice Voucher Program. It's a program that subsidizes the rents of low-income families so they can afford to rent apartments at market rates. In fact, though, that program serves primarily to reinforce segregation because landlords in most places, not in California, but in most places, are permitted to discriminate against Section 8 voucher holders, that is not to rent to families that use these vouchers. And the vouchers aren't great enough, there's not enough money in them, to afford to rent in middle-class neighborhoods. They only are big enough to rent in already segregated neighborhoods. So the system reinforces segregation. The other program that the federal government runs is the Low-Income Housing Tax Credit Program, which is a run from the Department of Treasury and gives a tax credit to developers who build low-income housing. And again, this program reinforces segregation because developers prefer to build in already segregated neighborhoods where land is cheaper, where there's no community opposition, and where the project is visible to prospective tenants who will rent more quickly. Both of those programs could be reformed to place a priority on the opportunity of families to live in middle-class neighborhoods and high-opportunity neighborhoods with this access to jobs and transportation and supermarkets and the other amenities of a normal middle-class American life. So those programs need to be reformed, and that's a short-term policy that could be implemented. The biggest housing program that the federal government runs is the mortgage interest deduction, which is granted to single-family homeowners, again, throughout the middle-class suburbs, many of them predominantly white. And we could begin to place restrictions on that mortgage interest deduction if it's used in communities that are segregated. Perhaps withhold the mortgage interest deduction from homes in those neighborhoods, perhaps put it in an escrow fund until the suburbs began to take steps to desegregate. So those are the kinds of reforms that we would begin to talk about if, again, we had a conversation that was based on an accurate knowledge of how this segregation happened.
I want to go back to your point about Section 8, which is, I understand there's some difference between different jurisdictions in California. There may be some different laws, but certainly here in Sacramento, landlords are free to not accept Section 8 vouchers and to discriminate against that source of income. So my guess is that's playing out here in Sacramento, and some of the reporting I've done suggests it can be very hard to find a place in any kind of neighborhood with lots of opportunities.
Yes, in most places in this country, most parts of this country, there are some places that have prohibited discrimination against Section 8 voucher holders, but in most parts of the country, landlords are free to discriminate. But there's a much more fundamental problem, and that is that even if landlords didn't discriminate, the number of apartments that are affordable to families with a Section 8 voucher in high-opportunity neighborhoods is very small. The voucher is not great enough because rents are higher in high-opportunity neighborhoods and middle-class neighborhoods than they are in segregated neighborhoods, and the voucher amounts are calculated by the government on an overall metropolitan-wide average, so that if you have a voucher that's sufficient to rent an apartment at the average rent in a metropolitan area, it doesn't help you to rent an apartment in a middle-class area because the voucher is too small. In fact, the opposite is also true. The voucher amount is too high for segregated neighborhoods, and landlords are able to exploit families by charging more than market rates in segregated neighborhoods because of the way in which this voucher is calculated. In the last couple of weeks of the Obama administration, it adopted a rule which adjusted the voucher amounts so that families in many cities could get higher voucher amounts if they moved to high-opportunity neighborhoods. That rule has not been enforced by the Trump administration. In fact, the Trump administration sent a notice to housing agencies around the country telling them not to implement that rule because it said that the Trump budget was not going to provide sufficient funds to permit housing agencies to top up the vouchers in middle-class neighborhoods. So that's another area of reform that needs to be addressed.
So given our current political culture, what are the chances right now of sort of unraveling some of these old patterns?
Well, I think we can make a start. As you mentioned earlier, since the events in Ferguson and other cities, since the growth of the Black Lives Matter movement, there's much more discussion in this country about these issues than there was, say, 10 years ago. The discussion needs to continue. It needs to become more widespread. People need to become aware of this history to a greater extent. But I am hopeful that we can do it. You know, one of the things about this book of mine is that it did leave me with greater hope than I had before, because if we believe that all of these problems that result from residential segregation happen by accident, it's very hard to figure out how they can be undone. But if we understand that they were created by government, it's easier to understand that they can be undone by government. And so we have a way forward, and we need to extend the conversation throughout the country about it and build support for reform.
That was Cosmo Garvin's September 2017 conversation with Professor Richard Rothstein, senior fellow at the Haas Institute at the UC Berkeley School of Law. Rothstein had recently written his book, The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. This is Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio.